What's up? Welcome to the Plus Pitch Podcast, your morning starting pitching podcast brought to you by PitcherList.com. My name is Jake Crumpler, and this is my first edition of the Plus Pitch Podcast. Let's break down every single start from Friday, July 31st. My opener here is Paul Skeens. We've got to talk about him. I've told you, Nick has told you, don't worry about Paul Skeens. All year long, he was the 2023 first overall pick, the 2024 National League Rookie of the Year, and the 2025 National League Cy Young Award winner. He deserves to have some trust, some leeway to work through the struggles and misfortune. He's still throwing hard. He's throwing plenty of strikes. He's racking up whiffs and punch outs. But after Friday's disappointment in Cincinnati, where he went four innings, allowing five earned runs with seven hits, four walks, and seven strikeouts, it's time to take a deep dive into Paul Skeens, to look behind the scenes to figure out what's wrong. Maybe that disastrous opening day was just a bad omen that we really should have heeded, as Skeens has pitched to a 5.18 ERA across his last 14 starts. He has seven starts with four more runs this year, which includes a career worst seven earned runs back on July 1st. Compare that to a mere five starts with four or more runs in his first two seasons, which accounts for 55 starts. He's eclipsed four just once during those previous two seasons, and he's done that five times this year and now has done so in consecutive starts. So really, that's what's happened, and it's grabbing headlines. But what's the cause? Everyone's pointed to Paul Skeens' declining velocity. He averaged 98.2 miles per hour with his four-seamer back in his debut campaign in 2024. He bumped that up to 98.8 miles per hour in 2025 when he won the Cy Young. But he's seen that four-seamer velocity fall to 96.9 miles per hour this year, dipping as low as 96.3 miles per hour. Is he injured? Is he taking something off to prevent injury and to allow him to command more effectively? Has it even mattered? His fastball has never had ideal shape. That was something even before he was drafted that everybody talked about. Wow, Skeens throws hard, but he doesn't really have great fastball shape. But it's noticeably changed this year, as he's added a couple inches of IVB at the cost of arm side run. You'd think, based on the results this year, that the reduced velocity and altered shape have impaired his heater, but that's not the case. Compared to its 2025 peak, Skeens' four-seam fastball has the same strike rate, the same ideal contact rate, and a higher swinging strike rate. It holds a lower called strike rate due to a significant drop in zone rate. That's really just a result of increased locations above the zone, as he's shooting for more chases, and maybe that's why we see a higher swinging strike rate. But he's also given up a higher rate of home runs, and that's really just a luck-based thing where it's due to an increase in his home run to fly ball ratio. All of that is to say, while the fastball from Skeens appears to be worse, it hasn't performed worse, and thus we can't blame it alone for his struggles this year. On Friday, the four-seamer induced seven whiffs with 72% strikes, and it would have performed better if not for a ridiculous 30% foul ball rate, leading to 15 foul balls against the four-seamer that prevented him from inducing more whiffs and avoiding more damage. He did serve up a long ball on a first pitch heater located upstairs, but it otherwise dominated. So if it's not Skeens' fastball, it's got to be his secondaries. His sweeper hasn't been nearly as effective this year. Batters are not chasing the sweeper. It's led to fewer strikes on the pitch and fewer whiffs. And when it does come into the zone, it limits hard contact and hits, but it has allowed three times as many homers as it did last year. That's just three on the season, but that's significant when you're talking about a pitcher over a whole season with just one pitch. It doesn't stop there, though. Skeens' changeup is missing fewer bats and serving up louder contact. His sinker is missing fewer bats and serving up louder contact. His splitter is missing fewer bats. His slider is serving up louder contact. As you can tell, there's sort of a common theme here with the secondaries from Paul Skeens. It could be a pitch movement problem. His off-speed pitches have lost depth and run. His sinker and fastball have become more similar. Their movement profiles are more similar, so there's less separation there. And the velocity decline has led to less distinct velocity bands. It could be a location problem, maybe. Sweepers aren't landing low or glove side as often as they should, while changeups, splitters, and sinkers aren't landing low or arm side as often as they should. It's obviously, though, a confluence of factors, with secondaries declining in both their ability to miss bats and avoid allowed contact due to diminished movement and command. There's a heavier reliance on heaters with diminished velocity, making him more predictable and easier to square up as batters aren't in between velocity bands or failing to decipher the difference between his fastball variants. There's so much going on that it leads to more hits, more homers, more walks. And honestly, I think that means Skeens has lost some confidence. He has an unwillingness to fill up the zone like he did in years past for fear of teeing up batters for home runs. He's nibbling around the edges, leading to more walks. He's trying too hard to be perfect. It's a vicious self-sustaining cycle that gets worse before it gets better. The poor luck Skeens has faced only exacerbates the struggles. A higher rate of homers on fly balls, unsustainable BABIPs, inherited runners coming around to score, it all just adds to the madness, frustrating both the pitcher and fantasy managers who want someone to blame other than the baseball gods and Koufax. Ultimately, the results have been too extreme to suggest it's all the fault of the decline of Skeens' stuff or command. You can't really say he's so much worse that he deserves to be somebody that we don't want to roster at all. So what can you do? It seems like insane to bench Paul Skeens at this point. He's still striking out north of 30% of the batters he's faced. He's still racking up whiffs with the best of them. He did both in this outing on Friday in Cincinnati, and everything suggests better times are on the horizon for Paul Skeens. And yet we've been saying that for 2 months and it's really only gotten worse. At this point, it's your call. It really sucks drafting a highly touted pitcher early in draft just for him to underperform. And trust me, I'm right there with you. And if you want to give him a break until he looks like himself again, go for it. If you want to see him lowered on the list or into the probably start tier on the streamer rankings, I don't blame you. If I rostered him, I'd be starting him everywhere. He's a generational pitcher facing the first adversity of his young career. I'm sure he's never struggled this much throughout his entire life playing baseball. He's disappointed thus far, but we're in the business of looking towards the future, and I expect Paul Skeens to come out of this stronger than ever. Will Warren had a great start for the Yankees in Chicago against the Cubs, tossing 6 2/3 shutout innings, allowing 4 hits and no walks while striking out 7. We keep talking about who's going to stick in the Yankees rotation when Carlos Rodon returns or a rotation addition arrives at the deadline. Will it be Will Warren or will it be Ryan Weathers? Warren seemed to be lagging behind in that race, but he continued his trend of alternating helpful outing with disasters. He's sort of back and forth with the good starts and the bad starts, but he turned in his best outing since he fanned 11 batters in mid-April on Friday. That was the last time he recorded 20 or more outs like he did here. With his job on the line, Warren switched things up following the lead of his peer Weathers, who I've sort of pumped up recently because not only is he throwing harder in his last start, but he's realized that his fastballs are what are homer prone. And that's really what's led to him struggling recently. So he said, what if I just throw my secondaries a bunch? What if I throw my sweeper and my changeup a bunch and I just rely on my best pitches? And it's worked for Weathers, or at least it's got me excited about the potential for it working more often moving forward. And that's exactly what Warren did here. And maybe it's a coaching staff thing. Maybe the Yankees are pushing that for their pitchers. Warren cut back on his heaters, -14% on four seamers to 24% usage and -17% on sinkers to 10% usage. And that allowed his secondaries to shine. And honestly, for me, that would have been a questionable approach throughout the year as he struggled to command them effectively. I've consistently compared Will Warren to Emerson Hancock, a guy who's relying too heavily on a pair of fastballs and has been unable to find the secondaries to support those that he doesn't have to rely so heavily on them. But Warren locked in at the right time. Changeups landed below the zone for 5 whiffs, while sweepers snuck in backdoor versus left-handed batters and front door versus right-handed batters as it racked up 6 called strikes. The new approach allowed his previously overused heaters to avoid the wrath of his opponent's bats. One start, though, that's an outlier. That's an aberration. I need to see Warren do this again before I can buy into it being a sustainable approach. He needed a lot of help from Koufax, too, via 12 outs on 16 balls in play, despite allowing 63% hard contact, which suggests that he should have allowed more damage on all those balls in play. He also induced double-digit whiffs for just the second time in his last 13 starts, during which he's pitched to a 4.70 ERA and an 18% strikeout rate after doing so six times in his first nine starts, during which Warren had a 3.42 ERA and a 30% strikeout rate. So when he's racking up whiffs, he's pitching a lot better. And recently, he's not been racking up whiffs. Honestly, if he's still in the rotation for his next scheduled start against the Cardinals, I'd say feel free to give it a try, in the hopes that this noticeable change leads to amazing results once again. Next, we've got Germán Márquez, who pitched against the Giants, tossing five shutout innings, allowing one hit and one walk while striking out two. He actually was a follower as Bradley Rodriguez and Yuki Matsui combined to cover the first four innings of that game, setting Márquez up to earn a rare five-inning save, the first of his career. I guess if Mason Miller is traded at the deadline, Márquez might have a career as some sort of old-school closer. He's sitting a tick down, so he definitely can stay in character with those soft-tossing pitchers of old. On a side note, though, I'm disappointed to see that the career-best 17 to 18 inches of IVB that Márquez had in his last start was merely an outlier caused by pitching indoors at Lone Depot Park. And there's really not much to get excited about Germán Márquez at this point in his career. Next, we have Jansen Junk, who pitched in Queens, tossing five scoreless innings, allowing three hits and two walks while striking out four. No one wants Junk to succeed more than the pitcherless staff, especially because we keep putting out those pitcherless cards with A-grade stuff for Junk all the time. To be fair, it's not just us that think Junk has amazing stuff. Stuff Plus has him ranked 44th among pitchers with at least 70 innings pitched this year. But player card adoration aside, Junk still failed to parlay his awesome stuff into comparable results. The ratios are cool here. Zero ERA. That's a one whip with three hits and two walks here. But just two whiffs? How am I supposed to keep my house cool without the breeze of bats missing balls? I don't think that's the next how am I supposed to butter my bread with that. But I also don't think Junk is going to stick on our fantasy squads until he does something other than filling up the zone with a bunch of junk. And I know that's a very easy pun to go for, but sometimes you just got to take the easy ones. Next, we have Edgardo Henriquez opening for Cole Irvin. Yes, Cole Irvin. He's still around, and I was just as surprised as you are. He's a former A's Toby who last appeared in the majors in 2024. He spent 2025 in the KBO pitching in Korea, and then he spent most of this year toiling away with the Dodgers AAA affiliate, but he got a bulk relief opportunity tossing six innings, allowing six earned run, eight hits, three walks, and five strikeouts. And this was clearly the Dodgers just throwing Cole Irvin out to the wolves in an effort to lighten the pitching staff's workload. Not only would I not be interested in him if he still sticks on the roster, but I'd expect Irvin to be designated for assignment before the start of the Dodgers game on Saturday. Next, we've got Tomoyuki Sugano, who helped the Rockies to win against the Royals, tossing six and two-thirds innings, allowing one run, five hits, walking nobody while striking out two. And if you dared to start Sugano at home, honestly, you should check your pulse. I mean, you're either like stone cold, nerves of steel, permanent, just expressionless stare. I don't mess around. I just get stuff right. Or your heart's beating out of your chest with the excitement of pulling this one off. I've been rooting for Sugano all year. I want him to be the first qualified Rockies pitcher with a sub-4 ERA in almost 10 years. Either way, regardless of whether or not you have emotions or not, we're rooting for you and Sugano to continue your success this year. Next, we have Dylan Cease, who pitched against the Cardinals, tossing six innings, allowing one run with three hits, three walks, and seven strikeouts. Obviously, that's an ace is going to ace for Dylan Cease. The velocity, though, still down one to two ticks, four ticks down on his changeup, which is sort of better. You know, you really want that changeup to have a large velocity difference between the fastball, and that's got to be a huge velocity difference. If it's down four ticks, he's probably around 79-80 miles per hour, meaning there's like a 18 mile per hour difference between the fastball and changeup. That's pretty cool. And Cease is still getting the job done despite the reduced velocity, but I have to remind everybody that when Cease was performing well earlier in the year and we were pointing to reasons to believe the sustainability of his success, a lot of that rode on his ability to throw harder. Obviously, he's not going to be somebody who controls the ball well. He's going to be somebody who walks a lot of batters. He's going to be somebody with an inflated whip. But we were all like, yo, if he's throwing harder, then he's probably going to pitch much better. And the results were supporting that. He was somebody who in the past was underperforming his expected metrics. And this year he's been overperforming them, if anything. And I think without the velocity, it starts to get a little bit tenuous. I really hope that this is just his way of ensuring that he finishes the season healthy, or that he controls his pitches more effectively, and that it's not some sign of an injury or imminent disaster. I really try to avoid living in a state of worry anyway, so I'm going to lean into that former group and just hope that Dylan Cease is trying to control his pitches better by taking a little off so he can finish the season strong. Next, we have Cal Leahy on the opposite side of Cease against the Blue Jays in Toronto, as he tossed six innings, allowing one earned run, six hits, one walk, three strikeouts. And while it's hard to ignore what Leahy's done recently, 1.21 ERA, 0.88 whip, and a 23% strikeout rate across his last seven starts, I don't know if I believe it. He did hold a 4.63 ERA, a 1.57 whip, and a 19% strikeout rate through his first 14 starts. So there's clearly a significant difference in his performance. So what's changed with Leahy? Literally nothing. Same pitch mix, same movement, same amount of whiffs and strikes. It's just been fortunate luck manifesting in a sub-200 BABIP across those last seven starts. He does have a 9% decrease in his hard contact percentage. Sure, I just don't think that's enough to warrant such a drastic shift in the results from Leahy. He's still a poor execution, awesome stuff, searching to find the command to break free from his hipster label. I don't think we're going to see that happen this year, but he's certainly somebody that we can dream on for 2027. Next, we've got Bryce Elder, who helped the Braves to win against the Nationals, tossing six innings, allowing one earned run, four hits, three walks, and three strikeouts, inducing six whiffs with 22% CSW. And that's not too shabby against the mighty Nationals. That's now three straight with two runs or fewer. And got to start asking, is Elder starting another Vargas rule similar to the one that he opened the season with? And I really hope not. I doubt it. Sub 60% strikes across his last two starts with a heavier reliance on fastballs suggests that Elder doesn't have command of his entire arsenal. We want to see him relying on those sliders and those cutters. And by all means, feel free to ride the start of this potential hot streak with the Marlins, Mets, and Minnesota coming up. But the ceiling really is not worth your time in standard leagues. Next, we've got Michael Wacha in Colorado. He tossed six innings, allowing one earned run, five hits with no walks and seven strikeouts. And I sort of gave him some space as he told me he was heading to Coors. And I was like, yo, this guy must be under a lot of pressure. Let's not ask for too much. Maybe let's bench him. And maybe my lowered expectations allowed Wacha to thrive in that tough environment. It's more likely that the thin Denver air allowed him to get some ridiculous movement on his changeup, leading to a whopping 13 whiffs and 42% CSW. I mean, some of the drop and run that he was able to get on that changeup, thanks to the thin air of Denver, was ridiculous. Too bad he signed with the Royals through 2027. Otherwise, I'd be employing Jonah Hill, aka Paul DePodesta, to sign Michael Wacha to a lifetime contract. He is back on the streaming menu versus the Twins before we give him space again to visit Hollywood afterwards. Next, we've got Eric Fetty in Tampa Bay as he tossed five innings, allowing one earned with four hits, no walks, and six strikeouts. And usually we say, don't trust the Feds, but I don't know, man. They're getting pretty convincing. That's a 2.89 ERA across Fetty's last 12 outings. And the White Sox allowed him to eclipse 90 pitches for the first time since June. He also dangled a 92-mile-per-hour cutter in front of my face, which is up 1.4 ticks. And he promised me everlasting happiness if I entrusted him with the fate of my fantasy team. I did not let him, but I am considering it. Please don't yell at me, but it's not the worst play in deeper leagues in Boston up next. I know that Fetty has induced double-digit whiffs just once this year, but he's been super effective at inducing weak contact. And this cannibal McSanchez approach with those high cutters really works when the cutter is coming in at 92 miles per hour. Next, we have Mitch Bratt in Cleveland as he tossed five innings, allowing one earned run, three hits, four walks, and two strikeouts. Arizona sort of becoming the Swatch Academy with young southpaws Bratt and Cole Drake getting a shot in the rotation simultaneously. Bratt is not my preference of the two. I prefer Cole Drake. And starts like these, where Brat walks twice as many batters as he strikes out, are exactly why he needs to review the lesson plan and realize that if he wants to graduate from the Swatch Academy, he'll need to throw more than 9 changeups. You got to throw at least double digits, bro. Come on. If you're a Swatch, you're throwing changeups. That curveball is not going to be good enough to support that low 90s four-seam fastball. Next, we've got Tyler Holton in Sacramento. He opened for Ty Madden, who went 3 innings with no runs, 2 hits, 2 walks, 2 strikeouts, 6 whiffs, and 25% CSW across 56 pitches. And Madden's probably going to want to blame pitching in Sacramento for this one, but he won't escape the wrath of my pointer finger. Look, decreased velocity. And over there, 5.7 feet of extension. That's not good. The fastball is not good enough. The rest of the arsenal isn't good enough to support that fastball. And there is a reason that Ty Madden is pitching in relief, and he's not allowed to pitch more than a trio of frames. Next, we'll talk about Tanner Bibee, Shota Imanaga, Shane Drohan, and more. But first, we're going to take a quick break here on the Plus Pitch podcast. And we're back. Let's talk about Tanner Bibee, who did all he could versus the Diamondbacks, but the Guardians lost. He tossed 7 1/3 innings, allowing 2 earned runs, 3 hits, 1 walk, and 3 strikeouts, inducing 8 whiffs with 31% CSW. The increased horizontal movement that accompanied Bibee's last start in the domed Tropicana Field expectedly disappeared. He headed to a different dome stadium at Chase Field and instead saw increased vertical movement across the board. And I'm not going to read into either of those because Bibee doesn't usually find himself pitching indoors, so we shouldn't see increased movement in either direction. What I will read into is the pitch usage changes that led to 60% weak contact and, albeit unsustainable, 18 outs on 21 balls in play here. Bibee relied heavily on cutters versus right-handed batters, swapping them for fewer sinkers while also tossing a few more sweepers, while left-handed batters saw an influx of curveballs at the expense of changeups and cutters. The erratic command, single-digit whiffs, and batted ball luck suggests this is an outlier start, but Bibee's been doing this nonsense all year. Even if he seems like a coin flip each time out, it still produced a 3.81 ERA, 1.15 whip, and a 19% strikeout rate. Those are great Toby numbers, and maybe his ability to sequence his pitches and trust his defense is something we should have more faith in. I've definitely had people trying to convince me to lean more into some pitchers' abilities to consistently get outs on balls in play. Bibee doesn't really seem like one of those guys because he doesn't consistently induce ground balls and weak contact, but here, weak contact. And with the pitch mix changes, if that comes again with weak contact in his next start, he's definitely a guy I would be trusting in points and quality starts leagues because of his ability to pitch deep into games with efficiency. Next, we have Shota Imanaga versus the Yankees. 6 2/3 innings, 2 earned, 4 hits, no walks, 6 strikeouts. And honestly, I was sounding the alarm bells with Imanaga below 91 miles per hour while heading to Yankee Stadium, where not only does he have to face the Yankees lineup, but that park is the third best park for home runs over the past 3 years. And Imanaga not only survived here, but he pitched in the seventh and earned the gallows pull as his splitter dominated for 10 whiffs. And honestly, I think we can just count ourselves lucky. He was barely north of 91 miles per hour while returning sub 60% strikes on four seamers. I think Koufax was watching over him too, as he allowed 13 outs on 15 balls in play. And he was lucky that both of the home runs he allowed occurred with nobody on base, allowing him to come away with just 2 earned runs. Now Imanaga gets the Dodgers again. And I don't think I'm turning off those alarm bells. I'm still afraid of Imanaga at the moment. Next, we have Shane Drohan in LA against the Angels. 6 innings, 2 earned, 4 hits, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts. He failed to come through against Rocky Road last time, but he made up for it, getting the job done in an equally favorable matchup against the Angels. He tied his career high with 7 strikeouts, executing the Blake Snell blueprint to perfection with fastballs upstairs and sliders low. They shined as bright as Chip Skylark's teeth, inducing 7 whiffs with 50% CSW. The Pirates up next and the Padres afterward aren't great against southpaws, so I think you're safe streaming Drohan a couple more times before he faces the Dodgers. Next, we have Andrew Painter in Baltimore. 6 innings, 2 earned, 3 hits, 3 walks, 6 strikeouts, 35% CSW to earn the King Cole. This was Painter's return from the minors. And behind beautiful brushstrokes of Breakers returning 47% CSW emerged that King Cole. This was as promising as it gets for Painter, and he went to the lab as sweepers added 2 inches of sweep, four seamers added an inch of rise, sliders added an inch of sweep, 3 inches of drop as well, and splitters added 2 inches of drop, 3 inches of run, and 3 miles per hour velocity. So everything improved across the arsenal, and he leaned heavily on that sweeper, and everything else sort of fell into place. There's still some polish left to prevent a trio of walks from Painter, especially on a night where none of his pitches fell below 60% strikes, but this is enough to get me excited and to see the results in his next start against the Nationals. And if that goes well, I think we're all in St. Louis afterwards. Next, we have Hunter Brown versus the Rangers, 5 2/3 innings, 2 earned, 6 hits, 2 walks, 5 strikeouts. He quelled our fears about the decline of his heaters by not only throwing sinkers and four seamers for 76% strikes combined, but he also recovered his four seamer shape and velocity. However, Brown inspired a new fear, the loss of his curveball. I know, spooky. The hook returned just 40% strikes and 5% CSW. That's terrible, as it failed to coax the chases out of the zone that make it such a lethal secondary. I think he threw it a bit too much into the zone, and maybe that's why it didn't lead to as much success. So with his heaters intact, I sort of have faith that Brown's going to figure out that curveball and return to his former glory with the Blue Jays in San Francisco and Angels up next. I think the schedule is primed for Brown's resurgence. Next, we have Bryce Miller against the Twins, 5 1/3 innings, 2 earned, 3 hits, 2 walks, 3 strikeouts. Speaking of declining fastballs, Miller is still failing to sit north of 96 miles per hour. Remember, he was 97 and 98 miles per hour in his season debut. He's also failing to sit north of the zone as too many fastballs fell in the middle and low. And honestly, I think he was aware of it too, as he pulled back on the fastball to feature splitters as his primary offering. The splitter kept him afloat with 8 whiffs, but this is Bryce Miller we're talking about. He used to be the pitcher we talked about as having an elite fastball with nothing to support it. Here, it returned 83% strikes, but it needs to be the pitch leading the charge. We do not need another Kevin Gausman in the American League, maybe in the National League, but we can't have two Kevin Gausmans in the American League. Next, we have Jeffrey Springs against the Tigers, 4 innings, 2 earned, 4 hits, 5 walks, and 2 strikeouts. And the sunshine and rainbows were obscured by a season-high 5 free passes from Jeffrey Springs. Across his last 7 starts, Springs has a 9 ERA. He also has more walks than strikeouts. Yeah, it's not going well for Jeffrey Springs. Next, we have Zebby Matthews in Seattle, 5 innings, 3 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, 10 strikeouts. And I guess pitching in Seattle is amazing, because Matthews racked up a career-high 10 strikeouts with a season-high 15 whiffs, the majority of which came via four-seamers and sliders, which were effectively separated high in arm side and low and glove side, respectively. That pitch separation allowed those pitches to excel. However, this start comes on the heels of a 1-strikeout outing, and I think you're now getting the sense of how volatile Zebby Matthews has been this year, and I don't have the confidence that he's going to carry over the same command or with ability into his next start in Kansas City. Next, we've got Ranger Suarez in Hollywood against the Dodgers, 4 2/3 innings, 3 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, 2 strikeouts. The Red Sox are really ramping up Suarez slowly. He threw 64 pitches in his return from the IL, and he got to throw just one more on Friday, 65 pitches. So maybe by the end of the year, he'll be able to exceed 75 pitches. The combination of that workload constraint and facing the Dodgers prevented Suarez from getting into a groove, but honestly, I have all the faith moving forward. He's proven long enough that his ability to command his pitches allows him to exceed what the underlying metrics suggest. Brian Bello followed Suarez with 4 scoreless innings, failing to maintain the added velocity that made his last outing somewhat exciting. And we won't know if there's anything behind the 0.66 ERA he has in 3 starts since returning from the minors until we see him toss more than 60 pitches in consecutive outings. And we haven't seen that yet. And I don't know if we will see that unless the Red Sox decide to trade even more from their rotation, or maybe Patrick Sandoval's gone and Brian Bello enters the rotation. For now, we don't have to worry about it. Next, we've got Kodai Senga versus the Marlins. 4 innings, 3 earned, 2 hits, 2 walks, 4 strikeouts. And after a month in the bullpen, Senga returned to the rotation. It went well until he issued back-to-back walks to lead off the fifth before serving up a double and getting pulled, only to watch all the inherited runners to come around to score. It was terrible. He's not throwing 97-plus like we saw in April. Forkballs were literally scooping out dirt with 27% strikes, and sweepers were favored over cutters, which is not my favorite development, and it's not looking promising for Kodai Senga, but he could stick in the rotation if Freddie Peralta is dealt at the deadline. Regardless, we're going to need to see a lot more from Kodai Senga before we're trusting him in standard leagues. Next, we have Hunter Green versus the Pirates. 6 innings, 4 earned, 7 hits, 2 walks, 4 strikeouts, and he's no longer displaying the 99 to 100 mile per hour velocity that he usually does. He was below 98 miles per hour here, and he needs that velocity to hide the dead zone movement of his heater. It's not terribly shaped, but it's not the dominating fastball that you'd expect when he throws so hard. And he's not finding the strikes on his slider that he needs to keep him efficient and allow his fastball to hunt chases out of the zone. I guess Green is considered a cherry bomb now, where he's going to have these blowups and he's also going to have starts of dominance. And I think he's a lot closer to Jared Jones than an ace like Chase Burns until he recovers his velocity and his slider feel. Next, we have Brandon Young versus the Phillies. 5.2 innings, 4 earned, 5 hits, 2 walks, 5 strikeouts. Young had a poor quality start in the bag before JT Realmuto took him deep in the fifth inning with a 2-out 0-2 slider that it was actually the sixth inning, excuse me. It was a 2-out 0-2 slider, just 1 strike away from getting that poor quality start. Not that that's that great anyway. Young's heater is living up to its name with an extra tick of velocity at 95 plus miles per hour. It was nearly 96 in his last start, and he's leaning more heavily on sliders, but the whole arsenal from Brandon Young feels like it's missing pizzazz. The four seamer is just not as great as it can be. I think that's probably because his arm angle is too high to maximize the pretty decent IVB he gets on the pitch, even if he's throwing in the mid to upper 90s. And none of his secondaries seem that great. The splitter was not great versus lefties. It's a volatile pitch in general. That slider hasn't been a pitch that's taken over. The sinker is one that I don't really want to trust. And Young's been a reliable Toby this year, and I don't think these changes, the increased fastball velocity and the heavy reliance on sliders, is going to change the fact that he is a Toby. Next, we have Ryan Johnson versus the Brewers. 4 1/3 innings, 5 earned, 6 hits, 3 walks, 3 strikeouts. And there was a while there where Ryan Johnson was looking a little like Randy Johnson, parlaying the potential of his first round selection into big league success. However, he's returned back to mediocrity, allowing a combined 13 runs across his past 2 starts to put an end to any interest in Ryan Johnson. Maybe he can learn a thing or two from the Hall of Fame southpaw and start throwing harder than 91 miles per hour on his sinker. There definitely needs to be some sort of change with this arsenal, because the cutter, splitter, sweeper, sinker approach is not one that has worked very often thus far. And I'm not sure I really trust the Angels to get the most out of him. Maybe Johnson just needs to start throwing left-handed like Randy. Next, we have Nick Martinez versus the White Sox. 6 innings, 6 earned, 7 hits, no walks, 2 strikeouts. And I guess the Vargas rule has come to an end, but didn't he just allow 6 runs to open June and then follow that up with a 2.70 ERA and a 0.96 across his subsequent 8 starts? I guess he did. So fine. Martinez deserves a mulligan, but beware, he gets the green mile next. He heads to Sacramento before heading to Colorado. So maybe this start was a blessing in disguise before he blows up in those 2 tough matchups. Next, we have Foster Griffin in Atlanta. 5 1/3 innings, 6 earned, 9 hits, 2 walks, 3 strikeouts. I guess we have another hot streak coming to an end. Griffin allowed more than 3 earned runs for the first time since May 19th, ending a stretch of 11 starts during which he pitched to a 1.72 ERA. And it was going really well until the sixth, which opened with a double, single, and a 3-run homer. And they didn't stop there. I wish they did. They left Griffin in to serve up a single and to strike out a batter before they removed him and forced him to sit on the bench and watched the inherited runner score like that scene from Clockwork Orange. This is a textbook careful Icarus. Griffin, too, deserves a mulligan, just like Nick Martinez, but this feels more like a consistent and expected decline as he slowly waned out of that streak where he allowed 1 or fewer runs in like I think it was 10 straight starts or something. He's also induced single-digit whiffs in four of his last five starts while failing to find the same success with his signature cutter. That doesn't mean we're going to stop starting Foster Griffin, but maybe it's a good time to sell high. Maybe he's going to start going downhill from now on and sort of regress to a level that is more expected from him. But I still think he's going to be worth rostering. Second to last, we've got Nathan Eovaldi in Houston, 5 innings, 6 earned, 10 hits, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts. And he seemed to get back on track with 7 innings of 1-run ball last time, but Eovaldi floundered here with one of his worst starts of the year. Curveballs missed bats, but four seamers failed to take the slack off splitters that lacked command. He either bounced them in the dirt or he left them center cut, leading to sub 60% strikes, 5 hits, and a pair of home runs against the splitter. With the Giants and heading to LA against the Angels upcoming, I think we should give Eovaldi another chance to figure his stuff out, but it's sort of getting a bit difficult to keep sending him out there where he has a 4.93 ERA across his last 11 starts. Eovaldi, though, I think has the stuff and the track record to keep going. He has been striking out a ton of batters while he struggled, so I think in standard leagues, you're going to want to trust him. Maybe in 10-team leagues, I'm probably dropping him, but I'm going to keep rostering him in the majority of leagues. And lastly, we have Carson Wisenhunt in San Diego, 3 1/3 innings, 6 earned, 7 hits, 4 walks, 3 strikeouts. And I was honestly really excited about the potential of Wisenhunt after he dominated with his changeup in his last start. He pulled off the Blake Snell blueprint and looked like a legitimate swatch with an incredible changeup, but his command was not as exceptional here. Slow balls and heaters combined for 54% strikes. And it was promising to see slider show up for 4 whiffs, 45% CSW, and 75 strikes, looking like the pitch that will save him when one of his two primary pitches doesn't come through in the future when they're coming through more often together. However, it's clear that the double-digit walk rates from Wisenhunt's time in the minors were no fluke. He's got some work to do in the command department before we can trust Wisenhunt in standard leagues. And if we're looking forward to Saturday, my game of the day, Quinn Matthews versus Kevin Gausman. Matthews is making his MLB debut for the Cardinals. Excited to see how that goes. And we're hoping that Kevin Gausman returns to form or continues to return to form. But that'll do it for this episode of the Plus Pitch Podcast. Make sure to head over to pitcherlist.com to read the SP roundup and sign up for PL Plus or PL Pro to gain access to all of the incredible features we have on the site. You can follow me on socials at Jake Crumpler, and you can find all of my work at crumplerbaseball.com. But talk to you all tomorrow.